Assemble! What is up? How are you? It's Friday fucking night, and we're bringing you a second podcast of the week. Jay, what's up? How are you, man?
Yo, if I was any better, I would be dead.
Wow.
Wow, cut that. I'm doing fantastic.
Fix it in Pro Tools?
Yeah, fix it in Pro Tools. It's Pro Tools, really. I am doing fan-fucking-tastic. We had a great week. It is the weekend, as Rory mentioned. So now we are able to just fucking relax.
Yeah. Remember on Monday how we were all, like, pissed off after drinking two beers? I'm like, God damn it, we can't have another beer because it'll ruin our next day of being productive at work. And now we're here 5 days later, and this story is the most boring thing I think I've ever said.
Productivity be damned. But we did have a productive week, right?
I think so.
Busy as hell.
Super fucking busy. And a little bit of bad news for the podcast. This will be our last podcast for 3 weeks as I am making my merry way to London and Scotland.
The pilgrimage home.
But a bit of good news. My very good friend Padgett, who has been mentioned on this podcast before, has so kindly agreed to do on-location beer tasting. So we will be bringing you a little bit of bonus content. It will probably be a lot like this podcast anyway. Like, we'll just go off on a bazillion tangents and talk about days gone by. So,
but you got to lock it behind a OnlyFans and a Patreon. And
oh, yeah, got to put it behind a paywall.
That's right. Yeah,
sure.
Paywall that shit.
Yeah. Because Padgett, right? You see, he made his first trip to Calgary when, like, shortly after I got here. It was like Super Bowl 50. That's my
what are we on now?
That's 58.
Oh, okay.
So do the math.
Quick maths.
So, that's my reference point for years gone by. So that first year, Annalie and I were like, okay, dress warm. It's going to be fucking cold. It was like, you know, it's February, right? So it's really, really cold. And like that year we were going through like what we're going through now.
Just a heat
like
snap.
Just nice and warm and like nothing. Mm. I was like, this is bullshit. You guys have me worried for nothing. You're just messing around with me. So anyways, fast forward a few more years. Annalie and I are getting married. And Padge and his lovely lady come over. And we go... I'm more educated in Calgary beer and into my beer a lot more. So I take him around all my favorite breweries.
So I had to listen to you ramble on about how Alberta beer is the best beer, huh?
Well, I wasn't rambling on. It was listening to the truth.
Okay.
But anyway, so after he went back to the UK, he was like convinced that he could find. Now, just fucking, you're sitting down. Good. You might need to buckle in. But he,
buckled.
Yeah, good. Okay. You know, operating heavy machinery or anything, that's good.
No, sir.
So Padge is convinced that he can find a NEPA. God, I don't even want to say the fucking words. He's convinced he can find a NEPA that is as good as, wait for it, Cabins, wait for it,
Supersaturation.
Jinx.
Yeah, insert laugh track here, right? First of all, are you going to find... Okay, I don't know about Scotland, but I do know about, like, Germany. You're not going to find... You could find a NEPA there, but German brewers aren't going to make a NEPA. I doubt Scottish brewers are going to go... I'm not going to do a Scottish accent. But they're not going to be like, oh,
thank you for sparing us that.
Oh, yeah, we'll just make a NEPA. Like, I feel like Scotland could make... good Scotch ales, right? Scotch, Scotland, eh? There you go.
Have you had Innocent Gun?
I have. It's good. I feel like that's more of a macro. Like, I don't want to judge Scottish beer on that, but...
No.
But if you're going to go for a New England IPA, there's no better place than... New England, right?
Get the fuck out of here.
Craziness, I know. Like, a West Coast IPA, you're not going to get a great one in Scotland. Like, you might get an imitator. You might get something that's good, but... I feel like Scotland isn't known for its beers, and that's okay. Scotland is known for an entire other category of alcohol.
I will say though. So when the fuck did I go there? During the pandemic, Annalie and I went over. It was Christmas time, and We went down the craft brew aisle, and that, it has expanded since the previous time I was there, which is when I proposed to Emily. So that was, I don't know, a bunch of years. But there's a flaw with producing alcohol in, I don't know if it's UK wide. I'm almost certain it's Scotland. I'm certainly going to hear about that. In fact, now I'm saying it out loud. Definitely it's Scotland, because there's a bunch of convoluted politics and devolved powers and blah, 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 blah that I will not bore you with because it bores me to tears. What they do is if your beer is or anything is above a certain percentage, you get taxed more on it, and so then you have to pay more on it.
Do they do the same thing with just scotch too?
I have to assume so.
I didn't know if that got like a leeway because it's like a cultural thing, right?
No, I don't think so. But it's actually like... they also have a sugar tax. They introduced that quite a while ago. It's because like there's a massive obesity crisis in Scotland.
That's such a English thing to enact a tax on. We will tax everything.
No. That wasn't England putting that on.
That wasn't the House of Commons.
That was not the House of Parliament in London. Okay. That was Scotland's government being like, guys, it's getting bad. We are starting to sink into the ocean. We are so fat. We need to address this.
You think the person writing the bill was like munching on some M&Ms while he was doing it? Or like...
No. They had a drip. Just a drip for the sugar.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a fun fact for you. Did you know there is one drink that outsells Coca-Cola in the UK? Just one.
Is it a soda?
Yep. Soft drink.
Is it Iron Brew?
Fuck you, man. That was my interesting fact. Fuck you. How do you know that? Fuck you.
I'm worldly.
Fuck off. have you had Iron Brew?
I saw it in the store here. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then I walked away. But I wanted to try it. I've heard of it.
It's very expensive here. Mm-hmm. But I find it delicious.
Is it Scottish?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's the only thing that outsells Coke in the UK.
In all of the UK, okay.
Yes.
So you're telling me that we don't have American dominance there?
No.
So okay, go fuck yourself. We'll try it.
Yeah.
Coke will buy
it. It's really good. I would highly recommend it, man.
Is it Buckfast? Is that another... That's not a soda, though.
No. Well, I mean, some parents will give that to their children.
Have you had it? Is it...
It's disgusting. It's not classy. It's foul. It's what all the winos drink.
Oh, it's the go down to the liquor store, get a $3 bottle.
Like a Colt 45 or whatever.
Yeah,
okay. That's what it is, right? It's cheap, it's high in alcohol. But yeah, back to the sugar, the old sugar tax
thing. Oh, yeah.
So a bottle of Coke, back when I were a lad, was like £1 for 500 mils.
Mm.
Okay? Standard size bottle. You have them here too. Although in the States, they're like 2 liter bottles for $1, right? That fucks.
Hey, $1.50.
Sorry. Inflation, yeah. So what they did, they enacted this tax. So what they did to get around the tax was they made the bottles smaller, but they charged the same price for it.
Oh, the shrinkflation.
Yes, shrinkflation.
Shrinkflation, yeah. They're doing the same kind of thing here, too.
Are they?
Yeah, like, if you... It's like candy and chips and like junk food. If you look into it, it's like, oh, there's used to be this percentage of air in a bag of chips. Now there's this one.
Why have the air? Huh? I mean, I guess it like protects the chips from like turning into
kind of, but like you know, you open a bag of chips like a snack size bag of
you need
chips.
Some fucking binoculars half of it to see the bottom. Yeah?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And Pringles have gotten smaller. And there's another thing too that. Well, this is kind of going off a bit of a tangent, but McDonald's, the people were talking about the cost of buying McDonald's now. It's no longer affordable, and that McDonald's had like an earnings call, and they were saying that families that make under $45,000 a year USD can't afford it anymore. They don't go to McDonald's.
Mate, Annalie and I went. You know, we were having one of our drunken nights or whatever, and we went through. I think we went through a drive-thru. It doesn't matter. We went in to get some food, and we ordered, like, you know, just two meals, right? Mm-hmm. Burger, fried drink, times two. And it came to, like, $25. And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What the fuck is $25? You know, like, when I was working there, I used to work at McDonald's. We call them extra value meals.
Yeah.
And they were like £3. So let's double that and be generous and say $6 a meal. So $12. How the fuck
do you go from
12 to 25? It does not compute.
It's gotten to the point where Heather and I were going through the drive-thru, and I like to get my double quarter pounder, and I'll get some nuggets. I'll eat a couple nuggets with it, and then I'll save some. And she was like, gross. I was like, yeah, well, no, air fryer. If you put McDonald's nuggets or fries in an air, I don't know about fries, but the nuggets the next day, they're fine.
Really?
They taste better than when you got them. So if you air fry nuggies, do that. But so anyway, we're going through, and Heather was like, hey, I want a McDouble. And I'm like, okay. Ugh. And she's like, but tell them big, like dress like a Big Mac or Big Mac.
Oh, that used to be the hack.
Yeah.
That,
and so I was like,
that worked for the longest time.
And it's still, I think it still does because like it happened unless they charge me for it.
They charge you for it now.
Oh, cause she was like, no. If you tell them that, and I'm like, I've never heard of this. She's like, no, just it's a McDouble dressed as a Big Mac.
I only heard of that when I was living here in Calgary. It has to be a Canadian thing. And it is fucking genius.
It is.
And like the 2 times that I got it before they started jacking the price, it's brilliant. You're just throwing away that shitty piece of middle bread.
Yeah. And no one wants it anyway. Like, no one wants... When they get a Big Mac, they're like, oh, boy, I can't wait for my middle piece of bread. Yeah. Who the fuck wants a middle piece of bread in a Big Mac?
But the Mac sauce, man.
No, it is good. It is. So the Mac sauce is good. So what did we do the other... Like, so Heather and I, like, we've been really good about fast food in 2024. We've been cutting it back and just trying not to. So the other night, we're like, let's fucking do this. Like, let's be bad, right? And I look at her, I'm like, we're going to be bad. She's like, yeah. But we didn't want McDonald's burgers. We wanted A&W burgers. But we wanted McDonald's fries. Dude, so we
did the grown-up thing. Are you fucking serious? Dude, I'm a grown-up, so I can get whatever I want.
So we went through A&W. We're like, bam, give us them burgies.
Wow.
And then we went to McDonald's, and we're like, 20-piece nugget with 2 fries, please. We didn't kill it all in the night. Like I said, the nugget hack, right? We had 5 nuggets between each other or whatever. We saved the rest. And we got the fries with the A&W burgers. It's such a... It sounds so fucking degenerate, but it was...
Okay, no, actually. Where was the McDonald's and where was
the A&W? They're pretty close. They're close. They're like in like the next plaza over. Like, yeah, that's fine. Like, that's okay because we don't ever do it. Like, I'm more bad about fast food than she is because... She knows how to cook, so I get in the kitchen, and I'm like, oh, I guess I'll make ramen. But I think today she's been making this pizza toast that's so good. It's truffle oil, and like it's a piece of sourdough bread with some truffle oil, and then she'll put some sauce on there with some mozzarella and like freshly sliced tomatoes. And it's such a good snack.
That sounds...
It's like
so good.
It's bruschetta, fucking level up your game, right?
Bruschetta.
Bruschetta. So she did
we
that
do
stuff.
We do have Italians like, listening in, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Buongiorno.
Gonna get raked over the calls for that.
God damn, man. I can't learn this many languages. So, but yeah, it was phenomenal. Like, she's a hell of a cook, and if I was on my own, I would burn the house down and be like, I made noodles! So that, anyway, sugar tax and alcohol and shrinkflation. But yeah, so
oh,
you're
wait,
gonna
wait,
go.
Wait. Yeah. I wanted to bring something up. Yeah, I wanted to ask you. So A&W.
Yeah.
Are you? What burger do you go for at A&W?
So I'm relatively new to A&W because in the States, or at least in Florida,
yeah,
they don't have it.
What? But
it's not a thing.
I thought
there.
It used to be massive. Then.
It probably used to be, but
yeah,
definitely not anymore. So
yeah, what happened? Did you like?
The one time I remember having A&W in the States was in Mississippi. Unfortunately, I was living there, and I feel bad for anyone living there now.
Why was
it's just
we
backwards
just like
podunk.
Keep going down and down. And
I know,
down.
I know. Anyway, there was an A&W there, and I was like, their chicken strips are really good. I love their chicken strips. Come up to Canada, and I see like, holy shit, there's A&W everywhere. Like, I want the chicken strips. Dog shit. I don't know what the big difference is, but the chicken at A&W doesn't hit. But
I've noticed that.
Yeah. Like the teen burger, though. So to answer your question, the teen burger, I think, is what I got.
Yeah.
And it was good. We did try the spicy dill buddy burger or something.
Okay.
It's weird.
I feel like A&W has a hack, and all I ever get, I never get their massive like $10 burgers. I go the double chicken buddy with cheese and pickle, or the double buddy burger with cheese and extra pickle. Like,
so you just play
like,
it up.
And it's like $2.50 or $3.50 with the extra patty. And the bread is like, their buns are like amazing.
Yeah, their fries are bad. Oh, but I will say this. You want to hear something really, really fucked? A&W doesn't have root beer floats. You can't go there and get a root beer float.
I wonder why they stopped that.
Well, maybe it was seasonal, but I swear to God, we went through the drive-thru and they were just like, oh, we don't have that. I'm like, dude, it's vanilla ice cream and your actual product. Like, how could you not
How is this have difficult? That?
And so they're just like, oh, we're just not offering it. So Heather and I went to the store and we're like, fuck this. Let's get ice cream. Let's get A&W.
But don't you need soft serve?
I mean, it's better. Like, but yeah,
you need that like 95% canola oil
ice just like ice cream. Actual, just what I grew up on was Coke floats. And I guess that, I don't know if that's a big enough thing in Canada or if it was mostly root beer up here. But like when I was younger, like my dad would be like, hey, we're going to make Coke floats. So we'd always have Coke floats, Coke floats, Coke floats. And I like root beer floats, but Barks is the superior root beer, and it's harder to find up here.
I feel like I've seen Barks, but you can, I'm not, dude, root beer is a weird concept to me. When I first tried it, because, you know, when you first come to a new country, you got to try all the...
So root beer's not in Scotland?
I mean, it might be now. I mean, they have like a bunch of... like American candy stores, right? Where, do you know how much a box of fucking Lucky Charms costs in the UK?
I'm going to guess like £5. More?
Oh, yeah, dude.
10?
Like, I've seen boxes for like £20.
Dude, they're Lucky Charms. They're not that fucking good.
All import.
That's the same
thing. You know they got banned in the UK? Because we used to have them. When I was a kid, Lucky Charms got banned.
The marshmallows were too tasty.
So delicious. But it's... it's because of the goddamn sugar.
Wasn't there, I think there was a thing in the States that was like I want to know if somebody out there listening can tell me about this, but there was a thing, it was like, uh-oh, all marshmallows or something, and it was just fucking marshmallows.
I would eat that.
It's I don't know if it was Lucky Charms or if it was like something else, but it was like, uh-oh, all marshmallows or all something. Like, there was a different word in there. But yeah, it was like... like, my American fat ass going, that's the best part. There's a whole bowl of it.
I would love to try only marshmallows.
Dude, it was my poison of choice was Reese's Puffs, which I don't know. They're up here, I think.
They are, but I've, long since kicked my sugar habit, and I'm no longer a child, so I don't really go for the cereals anymore.
Oh, yeah, no, I just go for
raw. I do love the cereal, though.
Raw Pop-Tarts is my jam. Raw fucking Pop-Tarts.
Can I walk it back?
I brought in a pack of Pop-Tarts to practice one time, and Rory's like, are you going to eat those raw?
No, you were already eating it. I was like, are you eating a raw Pop-Tart?
Pop-Tarts aren't raw because they're fucking cooked already.
That's why it was funny.
I know. That's why now I eat Pop-Tarts, and I always think of that. Like, I eat a goddamn pack of Pop-Tarts, and I'm like, am I really going to eat this raw? So okay, so you're going to Scotland, you're going to your buddy Padge, he's going to show you a nipa.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's going to show me many. So actually, he sent me a picture of his boot, the trunk.
The trunk? Yeah. Oh, the car trunk.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's spent a ridiculous amount of money, and he's actually been working hard to try and find nipas to, like, taste and test.
But, like, what... okay, can you tell me a brewery of Scotland that I would know? Like, Innocent Gun, that's Scottish, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately now, because it's so big, right? It's like that band, that local band that you discover, and then they get big, and then they get signed, and then you're like, ah, fuck. Because I remember when Innocent Gun came out, and it was, like, hitting all the shelves, and, there was this... I used to work... just before I left the UK, I worked at this... I worked at this cafe on the Royal Mile, and it is there, but it's under different ownership, so blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. The owner is one of the greatest dudes I have ever met. He's like a second father to me. He's my dad's best friend. Mm-hmm. And pretty much every night when we were shutting up one of the easiest jobs in the world, one of us would look at each other and be like, want to go for a beer? And being on the Royal Mile... you are never more than five steps away from a pub. Dude, it's a fucking challenge to get from work to the bus to get home. You can't fucking do it without passing like 50 pubs.
Is that something like what is that Simon Pegg film? I call it a World's End. Yes, A World's End. Is it something similar to that?
What do you mean?
They did a pub crawl. Like they had to do a pub crawl and end at the bar called A World's End.
There's a very famous pub crawl in Edinburgh. I've actually never done it, but it's called the Rose Street Challenge.
Rose, like
the Rose Street. There's a street called Rose Street, and it's almost like a back alley, but it's parallel to Princes Street.
Uh-huh.
And it's just down a particular end of Rose Street. It's all pubs, all of it. And then it kind of gets a little bit more shoppy. Like there's
a cat on Rory's shoulder, and it's poor Stevie just wants attention, and she's on your shoulder. Oh my God, that's precious. Yeah, so Rose Street, back alley. There's how many pubs are there, you think?
Oh, dude, I couldn't count them. But the challenge is start at one end, make your way to the other, one pint in every pub.
Just a pint. And you still can't. It's a challenge.
Mate, you can't. There are a few.
That sounds like the drinking around the world thing at Epcot.
No, this seems a lot more difficult. Where were we? Oh, yes. We were talking. Oh, Innocent Gun. Right, there we were. So Innocent Gun. Yeah, so I remember like the first time we discovered it. I think we went up to like the Mitre on the Royal Mile, and they were like, "Oh yeah, we have this like Innocent Gun. It's aged in whiskey barrels." And we're "All right, let's fucking go." And it was amazing, like to discover it. And it wasn't big then; it was just coming out. It was so good. And then they came out with like other casks. So did them in rum casks, and the rum casks were like 8%. Now back then, 8% was like,
what the hell?
Redonkulous. Yeah. Because, I'd been drinking like Foster's and Coors. And so like when you hit an 8%, you're like, oof, man,
this is a beer.
Yeah. It's a man's beer.
Yeah. Right here, but I'll tell you what. But the rum, And not talking about that one because I've not had that one, but like any rum beer I've had, there was a rum coconut, and I want to say it was from, it's a brewery that makes Sculpin. I had it in Korea. My buddy was talking all about it, but there was a beer like aged in rum casks, and it was, it rubbed me the wrong way, but I feel like with the right style, it could be good. So I'm trying to find a good beer. Like, the same thing, I feel the same thing about anything aged in a cask, right? Rum, whiskey, scotch, any kind of barrel, I'm a little apprehensive to try.
Okay.
But Innocent Gun did it. I'm trying to figure out this. Ballast Point.
Oh, fuck, dude.
You know Ballast Point?
Yeah, I know Ballast Point. And you know what? Fun fact, Disneyland in California, that's the only brewery they have there. Like downtown Disney?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got, and when Annalie and I went there for a Christmas, we set up shop in Ballast Point and got fucking hammered. Like
it's a good brewery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out which one I had that was the rum. Anyway, the only good one I've had was like a coconut one. So like the coconut complemented the rum and it was very tropical, but a little bit rich. It's the same thing as like, I tried to make a, have you had a spicy beer?
Yeah, but I don't remember what it was. And maybe that's the point.
But like there's certain like flavor notes in a brew that complements the style. So like I tried to make an eggnog beer one time.
Gross.
Okay, but hear me out. Like a milk stout. I know you're not a stout guy.
Okay, no. Yeah, that makes sense. In that realm, right? That totally makes sense.
It got skunked, so I never got to try it. But
why don't you try it again?
I just didn't have the time, and the buddy I was brewing with kind of stopped. So we stopped brewing it.
Dude, that sounds so good.
Yeah, like it could have worked. But, you know, imagine an eggnog IPA. Sounds fucking horrible. Like, well, I wouldn't want to drink that.
I think it could work, because there are some IPAs that are like milkshake IPAs. I forget the brewery that did it.
Analog. Analog's got a peach milkshake. They got a peach milkshake.
But these milkshake IPAs that are like so creamy and smooth.
Yeah.
Like, you could do that with eggnog.
You could, but like, what about a... now I'm getting a little... avant-garde. But, you know, experimenting with styles and that, which is kind of like what we talked about earlier with music. This kind of blends into metal or music a little bit. But being out there and trying something new, like, oh, here's a milk stout. Oh, this is our take on a NIPA. Mm-hmm. And while that stuff is fantastic, and there are different ways to do it, a million different ways to do it, I also, like, I like weird shit. Like, Banff Brewing, they had...
They did a
white chocolate stout.
Oh, that fantastic.
It was the same consistency as a Guinness, and it poured like a Guinness, but it was a white. Like, it was a white beer.
Good.
And it was really good. It was so good. So good, in fact, that Heather and I went back to Banff afterwards, and we asked for it again, and they didn't have it.
It was gone.
Because she's not,
dude,
a big beer
fan. That's
the
worst.
And yeah, so it was gone. And so I'm like, well, because she's not a big beer person. She'll drink alcohol, but only if it's like tastes good, you know?
Mm.
And it's like, for her, it's not really worth it. Like, I don't get any enjoyment out of it, which is, you know, fair. A lot of people are like that. Like, I substitute my cake and my ice cream with my beer, right? Like, I'm not a sweets guy.
Yeah.
I like the bitter.
It ditto, yeah.
So, but she was like, oh, I really want that white chocolate stout. And I'm like, me fucking too. So we went there and just, they're like, oh, we don't have it. We've got this lime and pepper cilantro sour.
What?
And it was good, but
cilantro,
it wasn't as good.
Like, I really feel you're starting to take the piss at cilantro.
Hey, it was okay.
I'm a cilantro guy, but in a fucking beer?
When you're in Banff, I guess. When you're run by...
Did they offer you something similar? Did they say, oh, okay, we don't have the white chocolate stout, but we have this stout that's pretty cool?
They had another stout, but it was more in line with a regular stout. So that's why I try to go any kind of like for instance, Cold Garden. I know we're like so goddamn far away from the topic right now.
What did we even start talking about?
That's a good question.
To put you on the spot.
Shit, we went through A&W and McDonald's and now. Anyway, experimentation is something that I've always looked for, beer and music. So when I got to Calgary, yeah. I was like, you know, I had the Banff Avenue white, or not Banff Avenue, but Banff Brewing white chocolate stout. And then I went to Cold Garden and I was like, what do you guys have here that's like your unique take? And they gave me the cake face.
Oh!
Yeah. And I was like, what's that? And they're like, it tastes like a cake. And I took a sip and I'm like, holy shit. You're right. It tastes like a cake in a can.
Cold Garden does a birthday cake beer. Have you had that?
Is that the same thing as Cake Face? It's the guy, the can is like a face of like a guy.
Well, no, because that's from, you said you're in, that was Banff Ave?
No, Cold Garden.
Oh.
Sorry. So Banff Ave had the white chocolate stout.
Yeah.
Cold Garden has Cake Face, which is it's like a Marzen forward, like very malty.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's lager. What it is. Yeah, Cake Face. Yeah.
But yeah, that one was really... really tasty. So now I've been trying to go to these different breweries because there's so many breweries in Calgary where I'm like, what are you doing that's different from these guys?
All right, Jay, what have we got today?
I have brought a special treat for us to have. It is an Arrogant Bastard Ale from
finally.
Stone Brewing. So there are two beers I credit with getting me involved with craft beer. One of them is the Rasputin by Lost Coast or North Coast. It's a great one. Phenomenal. But this one is the one that I've talked about on, I believe, both of our episodes previous to this one. It is an Arrogant Bastard. It is a strong ale with 100 IBUs. So it is a tasty boy. 7.2% alcohol. And I wanted to go ahead and read this because this... it's not on the can that we have here, but it used to be printed on their bombers, which is the bottles that they'd have. My poetry voice. This is an aggressive beer. You probably won't like it. It is quite doubtful that you have the taste or sophistication to be able to appreciate an ale of this quality and depth. We would suggest that you stick to safer and more familiar territory. Maybe something with a multi-million dollar ad campaign aimed at convincing you it's made at an independent brewery, or one that implies that there tasteless seltzer, fizzy yellow beer, whatever the hell, will give you more sex appeal. Perhaps you think multi-million dollar ad campaigns make all that junk taste better. Perhaps you're mouthing your words as you read this. And then they go on. Actually, there's Jesus a bit Christ. More. But anyway, the whole tagline of this beer is you are not worthy. So, without further ado.
Hold it up to the mic.
Let's see if we're worthy.
Sounds delicious. Okay, and I will be rating Jay's pour on a scale of 1 to 10.
Well, it's looking like we're going for a strong one here, because this one's pretty easy and pretty tame to pour. We want to give a good head on that, so we're going to finish the pour off a little strong. That's a good fucking pour. Don't even try to fight it.
It's good pour. You have been practicing.
I know how to pour a beer.
I don't know about that.
All right, so I'm very curious. I want your honest thoughts right there. They're not a local brewery. You're not going to hurt my feelings. And no, fun fact, they a few years ago, they sold to Sapporo.
Oh, no.
Yeah, same thing with Anchor Steam. Anchor Steam is a San Francisco brewery. They sold out to Sapporo. The founder, so Stone Brewing was founded in 1996 in San Diego. Cheers.
Slangeva.
And Greg Cook, who I looked up to as, you know, a longtime fan of his brews, he sold it. He left the company. There was another owner, Greg Steele. I don't know if Greg Steele is still involved, but Steele something was the co-founder, but Greg Cook is the one who was kind of the face of the company, and he did a lot of stuff. He was a very, you know, 1996, craft beer was very much not a thing in the States.
I don't think it was anyway.
And so they went out, they came out with the Stone IPA, I believe was their first one, and it was a hit, and they took off with it. Then I remember being 21 going, arrogant bastard, I want to try that because I'm worthy. And it stuck with me. This was actually one of the first breweries I went to. I took a road trip out to California and I went to the San Diego Brewery. It's a beautiful place. Like they're very much into like locally sourcing a lot of things and the giving back and like very involved in the community, which I think a lot of breweries are these days.
Yes, I'm definitely here.
Mm. Yeah, you got all the good stuff from Calgary.
Mm. I will say licorice, yo.
Yeah.
Like that is the finishing taste of that beer.
It's been a really long time since I've been able to introduce somebody to this, so I'm very like excited and kind of like what do you think? Like, yeah, so licorice, I'm getting that. It's
I'm getting licorice and coffee. Like that's what I'm getting.
But it's weird cuz it's not technically a stout.
No, it is not.
It's I don't know, like I've never had another beer that tasted quite like this.
So yeah. No.
It's good.
I wanted to circle back on something you said about, you said, what was it? Stone Brewing, they sold out, right? Not in a bad way. They
sold, yeah.
And I have a horrible tendency to look down on breweries that, you know, quote unquote, sell out, right? Like Wild Rose, they sold out to Sleeman, I think. Oh, what's the other big one? Banded Peak sold out to one of the big three. I can't remember exactly what. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and the only reason I think that I'm disappointed is because, you know, these big chain companies, they come in and they fuck with what made it good. And they try and standardize everything so they can distribute it all over the world, which mm-hmm. that's their prerogative. But I guess getting older and maybe running my own business and looking at things like that, I'm like, yeah, fucking good for you, man. You had a dream. You followed it. You made it so good. Yeah. You did such a fucking good job that these people saw you as a threat and bought you out. Now you can retire. Like,
yeah,
I love it. I am all in for the blue collar, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstrap story. Sorry, I have to apologize for looking, you know, through the negative lens. I should be looking at it through the positive lens.
But it's hard, right? Especially if it's something you love, right? I mean, I think the biggest music example is Green Day, right? Green Day was so, they were like the heroes of punk music, and then they sold out.
And when do you feel they sold out? American Idiot?
before that, I mean, I don't know. I'm not the biggest Green Day fan. That's just the one that everybody keeps talking about that keeps coming up is Green Day sold out or so-and-so sold out. But honestly, if somebody came up to us and we're like, hey, we're going to give you guys $1 million and we're going to buy your albums and you're going to write, you know, 3 albums for us, like, we wouldn't say no.
No.
Like, who would say no to that, especially as someone starting out?
I was listening to a podcast recently, a fantastic podcast. Everybody probably already knows about it, all 40 listeners of ours. It's the WTF podcast with Marc Maron,
mm-hmm.
American stand-up. Absolutely sensationally hilarious comic. So underrated, it's not fair. He had Billy Joe Armstrong on as his guest a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And he was actually talking about that, what you were just saying, where it was like more of a question that Mark posed to Billy. And his answer, I was like, no, I get it. I've never been a massive Green Day guy.
Same.
Yeah. I loved American Idiot, but I've never been a punk. I've never, look, as deep as I go into punk will be, like, when I say I loved American Idiot, I enjoyed it, and it was easy to play on the guitar, so it was good to me. I'll do Green Day and Sum 41, the pinnacle of punk rock. There is no one that beats them.
Yeah, they're so punk.
I fucking love them. So Billy Joe Armstrong talks about that moment that you just described.
Yeah, it's a turning point in their career.
And you know what he said? So Mark says to him, like, oh, what do you... So you released this album, whatever album it was, and he says, you got a lot of shit for it. People say you sold out. Did you? And that's the great thing about Marc Maron. Like, he doesn't, like, give a fuck.
Did you?
Yeah. He doesn't give a fuck. He'll just ask the questions. And he was like, no, we didn't. He said, we just wanted to make high quality, better music. Mm-hmm. So it was just their journey of trying to achieve what they've always wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
So, but what's really unfair is that people are demonizing them for selling out. And it's just, yes, they were getting to a particular size and then they signed with a label, but the label didn't force them to do that.
But that's where
they were trying to make their music better. They wanted, they had an idea of where they wanted to go. Like, I feel that all the time when I write. I always, and I shouldn't do this, but when I write, I always measure myself against bands that I want to sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm not there right now. And whatever crazy fucking journey it takes me on trying to half-ass get where they are is going to be maybe okay. But like, I now respect and understand what they're doing, and I don't demonize them for selling out.
No, I think that's such a hard thing to do is when you... Shit, it's... So this goes back. All right. So let me tie this into a Lizzie McGuire episode. I don't know if that's something you fucking watched.
No, because I have balls.
No, I was younger and Hillary Duff is a saint. Oh,
she's hot. Okay, yeah.
So it's a Lizzie McGuire episode where Gordo really likes a jazz group. I think they were called the Rat Pack or something. But he really likes this jazz group because they were like his thing. Like, he was like, oh, I listen to their music. I have a connection with them. Then they sold out or something, and like everybody started listening, and he didn't like him anymore. And it's like that. It's like I felt when I was with Stone Brewing, to tie this back in.
Oh yeah,
is it was like they're my brewery. Like that's those are my guys. Like I love Stone, and then they sold, and I'm like, but they sold at a time. It was like a few years ago, and I was kind of like, good for them, man. Like Greg Cook has been at this for, you know, since 96. Like, let the man retire. Like, he doesn't want to be in the limelight all the time. He doesn't want to do all this stuff. He wants to go, like, he left a post on Twitter and he was just like, I'm going to be gone from the internet. I want to do my own thing. I want to live the rest of my life. Like, he succeeded. And then the same thing goes to these bands. When you have something perfect, and like, let's say like you come out with an album and then the next album is you're signed, right? Or the next brew that you've released or anything. Everybody always wonders, well, what was the involvement of corporate greed in what you made? Yeah. And the same thing goes into video games. Oh my God, the same thing is in fucking video games. If anybody out there is a gamer listening, like, everyone's like, oh, well, this game was good and the franchise was good until so-and-so bought it up and now they're monetizing the fuck out of it. And now some of that stuff is very, very apparent. And some of it is not. But, like, you don't know who's impacting. Like, if somebody were to buy out, I don't know, some indie artist tomorrow, but no one knew about it and they released an album and it was good, how would you know? Like, you're not going to know the level of involvement.
Just fucking... Every album's going to be different. And I feel like that's an easy scapegoat is to say, oh, well, they signed with these people. So, of course, like, that's why I don't like this album. But where I actually... It's not that. It's actually just like they've written something that's new and it's a bit scary to you. And you just have to give it a few, like, because when you listen to a band that you love and they bring out a new album, your mind is so occupied with the previous release that you love.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and then when this next one comes along, you're like, oh, this isn't exactly what the last one is. I'm mad.
But then you also get mad if it's not different.
So, what the fuck are these guys meant to do? So, maybe it's better... Look at us throwing down knowledge.
It's crazy. Like, there's so many... I mean, if you... It's you can relate it to Twitch streaming or just streaming in general. Like, if you stream one video game, you say, I am a Overwatch 2 streamer. I stream Overwatch. You get 1,000 people. The next day you go, I don't feel like playing Overwatch. I'm going to play... Fuck, I don't know, Red Dead Redemption 2. Ugh. You're going to get 100 people, 200 people. They don't give a shit about you, they give a shit about the game you're playing. So, like, the music industry. Lamb of God, I know I had to tie them back into this. I love Lamb of God, I love them. I think Ashes of the Wake is a perfect metal album. It's a perfect one. And Lamb of God kept releasing Lamb of God stuff. And it's great stuff. But it still sounds like, oh, it's more Lamb of God. It's good. It sounds more Lamb of God. Same with Iron Maiden, like if we wanted to even take it further. Iron Maiden is still releasing albums, and they're great, but it's more Iron Maiden. Then you get a band like, we talked about this, Muse, or hell, Taylor Swift. Yeah, let's bring her back into this. Taylor Swift is still here. When you change genres or an album, it's such a scary transition. And that's what Green Day, I don't know what their album was before Dookie, but I think the album after Dookie was American Idiot.
Was it? Was it really?
I feel like there might be one or two in between. But just thinking about the songs on Dookie and then the songs on American Idiot, they're so vastly different.
That thing put them on the fucking map.
It crushed them. Dude, they made it popular to wear pink and black as a guy. Like, that's how crazy. Because Billy Joe Armstrong would wear, like, the black button down with a pink tie, and everybody was fucking wearing it. So I think it's a scary thing when you shift genres or you shift tones. Like, the only band, Taylor Swift and then Muse, many of their albums will sound very different. Maybe not Taylor so much, but, like, if you go back and you listen to Muse on the album Showbiz, and then you listen to it on Origins of Symmetry, and then you listen to it on Second Law, like, all of their stuff, every album is a fucking change. It's just so different, and they still manage to keep their fan base. So it's a crazy, scary thing.
You know, that's... again, like, going back to my Scotland days, I went to see Alter Bridge. You familiar with Alter Bridge?
Yeah, that's Mark Tremonti's band.
Yes. Absolutely outstanding.
He's a phenomenal guitar player, I think. Oh,
yeah. And did you know he is now a phenomenal swing singer?
No, what the
fuck? Yeah, he's gone Frank Sinatra.
What?
Yes, my dude, everyone out there. Padge shared with me one day a video of his, because he knows how much I love Frank. Tremonti singing, you know, one of Frank's tunes, and now that he's touring right now doing Frank.
Doing singing?
Yeah.
Oh, he's covering Frank Sinatra?
Well, not exclusively. I have to assume it's like a broad brush that he's painting with, but yeah, he's singing Rat Pack stuff.
Oh man.
My point, what the fuck is my point? Miles Kennedy. Right, okay, so Alter Bridge. So when AB3 came out, it had not yet been released, but they were on tour, and me and the chick I was with at the time, we went to the show, and we were all excited for Alter Bridge. And they came out and they played, like, I'm telling you, man, 50% of their material was the new album. And nobody had heard it. Oh, nobody had heard it. Yeah. But And they recognized that halfway through the set, they said, "Look, guys, I know you've had to like digest a lot of new material you haven't heard, so thank you so much for being patient with us, yada yada yada." Because I think the album release was like a couple days after that or something.
Yeah.
So on the rest of their tour, they wanted to be playing the new stuff and supporting it. And that was AB3. And listen to AB3, and that's one of the strongest albums they've done. Uh-huh. It is such a great album. There was a classic example of that. Bob Dylan, in fact. Bob Dylan, he was a folk hero, right? Like he come down and...
What do you mean was?
Is, all right.
Is he still alive or is he...
No. Oh, shit. I'm pretty sure he's alive. But he... So he was known, or is, was, whatever.
He is.
Okay. Yeah. Known as a folk legend. Okay?
He's still alive.
And his shtick was coming out, sitting down on a chair and with his acoustic going, ooh, hee. That was his thing. And then he released an album. Well, no, he didn't release an album, but he was doing a tour, and it was with a four-band electric guitar. Everyone at that time,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Shit on him.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, he sold out. Boo, 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 boo.
Yeah.
But I tell you, those people now are like, oh, I was at that show. It was absolutely amazing. Isn't it funny how perspectives change? And with that, we are going to move right along. Beer news. Okay, take it away, Chief.
All right. So for beer news, my lads and lasses, we've got Rail Yard Brewing. They've come out with a dragon fruit lager. I'm not the biggest lager fan, but I love me a good dragon fruit.
Read it.
I will read it. So let me set you in the mood, all right? All right. Embark on a flavor adventure with their new dragon fruit lager, a captivating rendition of the bold and refreshing core lager. This infusion blends the lager's graham cracker. Yo, this sounds really good.
You broke character.
Graham cracker sweetness with the exotic characteristics of the dragon fruit. Immerse your taste buds in a symphony of flavors. Why'd you put that U in flavors? Making this brew
the ultimate... That's how you spell you, cunt!
Nah, you gotta take that U out. Making this brew the ultimate destination.
I'm American and I'm scared of
you. Refreshing. We just don't want extra letters in our spelling tests. For a refreshing and uniquely tropical experience. Okay.
For a country that has spelling bees, you're scared of the letter U.
Terrifies us.
Oh, God, so, I hate it.
Let me just talk about that for a second, because that sounds delectable. So, it's interesting that they put dragon fruit, because I would imagine that as like a dragon fruit sour or a dragon fruit something else, but they went with a lager. So I feel like that's almost going to make it a more full-bodied experience. Like, that sounds like they made an interesting choice.
Well, like the descriptor is, like, right on point, right? With, like, the graham cracker sweetness, with the dragon fruit. Like, that sounds like it would pair quite nicely. Does.
All right, next up, we've got a kind of a favorite of mine. So when I first got to Canada, I was up in Red Deer, and... Red Deer is very close to Sylvan Lake.
Population of 5.
Population of 5. Sylvan Lake, a population of 4. And Sylvan Lake is apparently an Albertan beach. You have a beach in Alberta.
Oh, God, dude. No, it's not.
Oh, it's a beach. No, oh, yeah. No. Oh, yeah. So,
I went to
Sylvan Lake.
Awful.
It's nice. It's okay.
Mate, you can walk to the middle of that lake, and it gets to your shin.
Yeah,
like,
but...
It is, oh God, and it's a mud puddle. It's not like...
Bro, you're landlocked. You're lucky you have that. But anyway,
no, we have
there's
nice,
a good
we
brewery
have nice
there.
Lakes. How dare you?
It's a Snake Lake. Go and on. This was actually the first beer I had in Canada was a Snake Lake IPA. Phenomenal. I met the... I went to the brewery. I don't know which person I met, but shout out. She was amazing. She was attending the bar, and she talked to me a lot about their brews. But Snake Lake is celebrating their 6th anniversary. They are re-releasing their birthday suit double IPA, which is a...
I want some so bad.
Oh, wait, they're releasing a whole bunch.
Yeah. Take a breath, man.
A double IPA, a sour porter. That sounds... really freaking interesting. Brett Farmhouse Ale. I know Brett. Raspberry Honey Golden Sour. Oh my God. No Way Rosé Sour Blonde. So wait, the rosé is in fact the sour blonde. A Guava Golden Sour. Party Queen Honey Farmhouse Ale. And a Sour Golden Ale. Those all...
Go get hammered, guys. Jesus.
Dude, when you're at Sylvan Lake... no one's probably going to Sylvan Lake right this second, but I'll tell you what. Go there. Go pay a visit to Snake Lake, because that sounds good. I've not had a bad brew from Snake Lake.
Have you been to the brewery?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been there when we went on a little...
Road trip?
Weekend away...
To the beach?
To the fucking legendary beach. The big mud puddle. It's a really beautiful tap room. It's a really nice beer.
Yeah.
There's another brewery up there called Hawktail. Yeah, Hawktail.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic NEPA there, by the way.
Wait, Hawktail's down here in Calgary, right?
No. It's...
But there's like... They distribute, don't they?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I did see
Hawktail. It's up there in Sylvan Lake.
Oh, okay.
So we did both of those breweries, and they're both, like, really good.
Okay. No, when Heather and I... Because we've been to Sylvan Lake a couple of times, and we did one... It's, I don't even know if it's a brewery. It's probably just like a micro or like a brew house, but there's one, there's like one on the main strip. I'll have to think of the name, but I was like, oh, before we go, like, oh my God, like Snake Lake is up here. Like, can we go? And she's like, yeah, let's go. So we went in there and phenomenal staff, super nice people. Like just really, really wanted to like show me that. Like they were like, I was like, oh, what does that taste like? They're like, why don't you taste it? Why don't you taste this one? And I'm like, oh, you guys are phenomenal.
I'll move it along. New Level. Valkyrie, not a sour blackberry ale, combines the taste of a pale ale with delightful notes of blackberry, brewed with wheat and oats for a smooth mouth feel.
A not sour New Level?
I mean, and it has the taste of a pale ale? Like, it kind of sounds interesting to me.
It does. Like, it's a blackberry ale?
Yeah. It wouldn't be right if I did not read the last item because...
Cabin plug incoming.
Because they are my heart. They are my people. I fucking love them. They finally released their first hazy of the year. And it's called the Kitchen Sink. And it's a 6.6%. Is soft and juicy. Pouring a delightful golden hazy hue with wild face-melting tropical fruit notes of melon, peaches, coconut, mango, and pineapple. It's a fruity delight, and it's ready now for your next kitchen dance. So Jay and I actually had some of this recently, and it was phenomenal.
Shout out to Cabin, man.
They do their hazies, and they do them right.
As much as I want to go against Rory on that, I've not had a bad brew from Cabin, and their hazies are just absolutely god tier.
Ooh, Swift Watch. I totally forgot to bring it up. So, have you seen people are losing their minds about Taylor Swift?
And the Super Bowl?
And the Super Bowl.
There's a fucking infographic of it floating around Reddit where they're like, if she leaves Tokyo at this time, she has this much time to get there to do this in Vegas.
And that's why I brought up the whole Fox thing last week, because that's what's true. But I was having a spirited debate with two people from the UK, Padge and Fern. They're really, really sick and tired of it. But I was kind of arguing that it's like, okay, well... Nobody was bitching when Spike Lee is shown at all the Knicks games. And nobody's bitching when Jack Nicholson is shown at all the LA Laker games. And nobody's bitching. And I fucking cannot stand this guy. I don't care that he's Canadian. I think he is a fucking plague on the planet. Nobody's bitching when Drake is at all these things cursing the team. That, like, dude, if Drake goes to a NBA, NHL, Super Bowl, anything.
Mm-hmm.
If he goes there and he bets on your team, I'm sorry you've lost. Because that's what happens. He's like, I'm putting 1.5 milli down here. And then they lose. You're like, fucking asshole. He pissed me off. But nobody's complaining about these people.
No,
now, all of a sudden, the most recognizable face on the entire planet is on TV and people are losing their fucking minds. And it's also, it's not her that's doing it.
It's the NFL.
It's not even the NFL.
Oh.
She has every right to go and support her man.
Yeah.
Who the fuck are we to say, hey, don't you, you're making it all about you.
Football.
It's all about you. No. She's dating Kelsey. she goes to the game. She's meeting, you know, the potential mother-in-law and all, you know, fucking Brittany Mahomes. Ugh. Oh, what a slob. But she's meeting all those people because they're going to be in her life. It's the media that gets a hold of it and then they pump it the direction they want to pump it. Right? Like, it's just... Leave her alone!
Leave Taylor alone! It's... Yeah, it's silly. You actually sent me a video about that where it's like, oh yeah, these celebrities get this many seconds of screen time. Yeah. And I watched it. I'm like, yeah, it's fucking right. Like,
Will Ferrell at LA Kings games. He's always fucking there.
Dude, it's like those people don't show up and they go, hey, when this happens, put me on the camera. I want to be on the camera. No, I don't want to be on the fucking camera.
They have special privileges because they're a big name and the teams are like, holy fuck, Brad Pitt, yes, please come in. Like, F1 is like brutal for it. Like, at Monaco or Miami or like just like any westernized race. And the celebs go everywhere. So whatever, I'm talking shit. But, you know, the amount of times I've seen Shakira on F1 is ridiculous. The amount of times I have seen Brad Pitt is ridiculous. Tom Cruise, Gordon Ramsay. Oh, fuck. There's so many celebrities all the time. So why is it we hate Taylor Swift and it's like, we've had enough? It's like, dude, you know what it is? It's like
sexism.
People are starting to hate Kansas City Chiefs because they
associate them with Taylor.
No. They're starting to hate Kansas City Chiefs because in the past 6 years they have been to every single conference championship and they've been to 4 Super Bowls. Right? They're tired. It's now like it's the old Brady hate, the old New England Brady hate. Yeah. It's just like they're fatigued with it, and it's like, you know what, bitch. If you hate them so much, beat them.
Yeah. Be better.
It's not their fault. Music news. Music news, Jay. Take it away.
Dude, I am so, so stoked about this one. So, it was announced a couple of days ago, or at least it passed across my feed, because that's how we get all of our news right now, is like social media and Facebook, right? Because the internet doesn't lie. But, in fact, the internet was right this time, and Italian... dwarf metal, you heard that correctly. A dwarf metal band called Windrose, who I've been following since, I guess since I discovered Ailstorm. They've been around for a while, I think the late 2010s, early 2020s. And they do dwarf metal. They're signed to Napalm Records, which is the same company that signs Ailstorm. They do a lot of really cool, like, themed metal signings. So, like, Ailstorm is pirate metal, if you don't know. Then you've got Windrose, who is dwarf metal, and you've got Powerwolf, which is like vampire and werewolf metal. Look, it's fucking great. I love it. I love what these guys do. So Windrose is actually going to be coming to Dickens April 24th in Calgary, and I am going to that show. It's going to be fucking great. Those guys look so fucking cool. I love it. I love their shtick. Like, it's great. It's going to be a fucking great time. After that, we do have to talk about Wacken, so... Wacken round 3 is coming. As we talked about earlier, our boys Hooker Spit from Red Deer actually won. So congratulations
to them. Boys.
They are going to be looking to represent.
Just remember, the reason you won is because you borrowed our drum stool.
The drum stool gave you the power. So
why didn't it give us a fucking power?
Dude, I don't know. But they got it. They're going on. They're going to represent Red Deer along with our friends Divide the Dead. And our third band will be decided. They will be from Calgary. We've got insider information that all of the bands coming up in Wacken Round 3 will be from here. We've got Rising Tempest, Neon Detour, Guar, and Infrastructure. So, they are going to be competing against Divide the Dead and Hooker Spit for the Alberta slot. Wait, Alberta? No, I'm sorry. Calgary slot. And then Edmonton is going to have their own heats.
So
apologies. They're going to be competing for the Calgary slot. So good luck to everyone in there. I know Rory and I have personally heard Divide the Dead and Hooker Spit play. Phenomenal bands. I'm curious to see who the third one's going to be.
My money not my money, my heart. My heart is on Rising Tempest. We met the fathers last night at round two. Very nice guys, and their kids are so young that they're not allowed in the venue until it's their turn to play, and as soon as they're done, they have to go. Like,
So Rising Tempest is like...
Rising Tempest, let's go.
All right, man. Yeah.
I'm in. Let's go. I'm putting my money on those bastards. And then our last piece of news is at Dickens. Again, are we like fucking spokespeople for Dickens now?
Hashtag not sponsored, but sponsor
yeah,
us.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we need a beer fridge because I hate going upstairs every time I need to pour one. Pussy Riot, March 7th at Dickens. Pussy Riot, infamously known for pissing off Vladimir Wankstein. And then he threw them in jail. So get on down to that and support anti-Russian movements. Band Spotlight. Heads, do we have a treat for you today? Today's band is one of Calgary's finest. They have opened for bands such as Buckcherry, Pop Evil, Silverstein, CKY, and I Prevail. It is A Path Less Traveled. I cannot believe these guys are letting us review one of their songs. And they've actually given us something particularly special, Jay. They are giving us something that is not released yet. It is coming from their latest album. This is completely unheard. So, fuck.
Damn, I'm stoked.
Yeah, I cannot wait. I am. My mouth is salivating. I am so excited. But just a quick note about Path Less Traveled. It's not. I'm just going to tell you who they are. It's Jordan King, Nick Skaggy, Mike Biggs, and Scott Bennett, who we have been working with his.
I know that guy.
Yeah, right. It's that guy.
That guy.
Yeah. So I guess without further ado, here is Alcatraz.
It's been 6 months of planning and hiding my life behind a wall. 2 years, count the days that I've been wasting.
But it's lights out at night.
Tonight's the night.
Yeah, it's lights out at night.
Where would I go?
Thank you.
We have
what
done it
a
again.
Fucking bop.
Holy fuck, I cannot believe those guys have done it again. That was fucking awesome.
Dude, that whole song was just from start to finish pure 100% energy the whole way. Like, I'm pretty sure I was picking up some lyrics along the way about, you know, the song called Alcatraz. He mentions a warden. Like, I want to get the lyrics to that. I want to go into it. I want to see what the story really is. So I'm probably going to bug you after we're done recording here to send those files my way. Well, maybe I'll have to ask Scott first if we can just start passing his music around. But that shit was dope.
Man, I feel like it was just like constantly changing. Like when you thought you had the song figured out, it was like, here's this little bit here. It was fucking cool, man. Oh man, yeah. That was so cool.
The arrangement of it was so, like, it just felt like everything was put in the perfect spot. And now I'm kind of curious, like, did Scott produce that? Do you know if he did? Or you know, I guess I can pick his brain about it later, but who produces the producer?
Yeah. Who keeps him under wraps?
So good. So fucking good, man. I'm stoked. I, you know, before coming to Calgary, I'm like, yeah, there's probably not going to be, this is going to be shit beer, country music everywhere. No. This city can put out some good musicians. That's for damn sure. Just like a path less traveled.
Well, I mean, look, we three episodes and three outstanding bands from our city.
Yeah.
Man, we're blessed. Hashtag blessed.
Hashtag blessed. Damn it. Hashtag blessed.
And if that wasn't enough, we have for the very first time a guest on the show here to talk about what you just heard. Guitarist, vocalist for Path Less Traveled, and owner of Interim Studios. Jay, give it up for Scott. Don't call me sugar. Bennett! Let's go!
You're bringing up my high school nickname. That's amazing.
So, yeah, Scott, it's great to have you here, man. How's your day going?
It's been a very full 24 hours, I'll put it that way. I had to go into work kind of last minute last night, covering for a friend, and everything that I was supposed to do yesterday and today has been truncated into one day. So, didn't sleep much, but that's how it goes.
Damn.
Gary V would be proud of me, you know? Crushing it.
All right, well, while we have you here, we are going to pick your brain about a few things. Give the people some knowledge that they are thirsty for.
Happily.
I guess to start off, we'll go with something pretty broad. What got you into music? What made you want to record and produce? You know, what geared you towards rock metal? I know that's a huge question for anybody to ask, but... Yeah, just maybe kind of guide us, like, what got you down this path where you are?
Yeah, so I grew up in a pretty religious household, Christian, and so this church every Sunday, and from a very young age, I would just, like, see, my favorite part of church was when there was a band playing the worship music, I guess you'd call it, and I was just, like, kind of drawn to guitar specifically, but yeah, I would experience live music in that way, and... I knew that if I put God into the mix when I mentioned this to my parents, it would, like, help my cause. So I was like, Dad, I want to be a worship leader. And he's like, oh, my God. So he, like, bought me a guitar, like, the next day kind of thing.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Dude, and, like, I don't know, just as a tangent, like, my parents were very, like, you can only listen to this band if it's Christian. And there were, like, Christian magazines that would be, like, hey, don't listen to Korn, listen to Thousand Foot Crutch, because it's the same thing. Or like there would be all
Demon
these, like,
Hunter, yeah.
Yeah, Christian, like, hey, please listen to this instead kind of thing. So I would just tell my mom every band of this song was Christian, or they had a Christian member or something to make it work. Anyways, so my dad buys me this guitar. Uh-oh.
Oh, there he is.
We're back. Dude, it's like you never left. It's great. So my dad buys me this guitar, and it was a flamenco Yamaha classical.
Oh.
I guess not flamenco, but a classical guitar, nylon string. I didn't know anything. No one knows anything. Mm-hmm. I think I was 12. And, like, I played this thing, like, for how much I played this guitar, I should be much better at my instrument. We'll put it that way. like, it was inseparable from that guitar. I went to a school that was, like, a bit smaller. So... sometimes I wouldn't, like, have I had friends, but, like, there would be different friend groups, and sometimes at recess and lunch and stuff, it was like other people were doing other things. Like, I wasn't super into sports, and that was kind of the thing to do at recess. So I'd bring my guitar and I'd play it for 15 minutes at break, 15 minutes or like 20 minutes during lunch. Like, I played it every day. I loved it. I played in the car on the way home. Drove my parents nuts. Like, honestly, the fact that any of us play music, our parents drove us to our gigs. Our parents, like for the most part, I'm sure there's like exceptions to this rule, but like for the most part, they bought us our first instruments. They paid for lessons, or they encouraged us, and they went through like audible hell. Like, not, yeah, when you don't, your guitar's not in tune. And like, just watching your son's first band show is probably awful, you know?
Yeah.
And just like, shout out to parents who paved the way for us to be able to do what we do, even hobby, full time, whatever. I don't know if parents get enough credit, and I appreciate them. So just a little tangent on that. But so yeah, I play guitar all the time, and sort of had that drop D moment where you're like, whoa, yeah, it's so much heavier.
I love that moment.
Yeah, and this is cool. Like, I used to, like, I'd pull up a tab, and if the song was in drop D, I'd be like, oh my God, I don't know what that is, and I would get stressed. And I just, yeah, like, yeah, would try and play it without it. And, like, it's so funny how that's changed. Like, the just, like, the accessibility of information.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I mean... I think a lot of guitarists are self-taught. Like, I would say I was self-taught. I've never really had a guitar lesson.
Bastard.
So you pick up some bad habits and stuff. But, like, the accessibility now. Like, I remember I had Guitarists for Dummies, and it was just, like, this dad with an acoustic guitar teaching you, like, row, row, row your boat or something. And now it's, like, you can go to YouTube and look at, like, Fluff or... Ola, or I don't know, like, pick your guitarist of your genre. Even like the dudes in Periphery are pretty proficient on YouTube and stuff. Like, you can have like a lesson that's catered to what you like already. You don't have to learn things you hate to like get into that. So like, I think it's great now what everyone has the availability to like get catered lessons, and or like things that can keep you engaged and make, or even like Rocksmith. I think that's an amazing technological achievement for people, like, learn how to play. I'm kind of rambling a bit. I apologize.
But no, that's what we do here. No, yeah. You are on brand.
Okay, perfect. That's great. So I was self-taught, played at lunch, played at recess. And then, like, there is something to be said about what a religious sort of institution can create in terms of musicians, because I was playing with different groups of people every week, because you volunteer to be on the band, and then on one week it's drummer A, and one week it's drummer B, and then there's like five bass players, and you all kind of rotate and whatever. So it's like you're in a cover band with no consistent members, but you're still playing the same songs. It's kind of like, it's kind of funny. And then if you played in the youth band, you'd be playing like more, we'll call it aggressive, it's not, but like more like heavier electric guitars and more electric guitar bass and like faster BPMs and stuff. So, like, and then on the Sunday morning services, you'd be learning slower things. So, like, I think I really learned from that the concept of jamming and the concept of, like, playing with, like, gelling with different musicians and, like, playing in ways to compliment people. Like, I feel like if there's one thing I took from my religious upbringing, it's, like, it was that mindset as being a musician, playing with different people all the time, and just playing. Like, it didn't really matter who I was playing with or what songs I was playing. I just wanted to play. And to be honest, because my school was so small, I didn't really have, like, I talked to a lot of my friends who went to like a large public school, and they had like choices on guitar players and bass players and drummers. Like, they were in bands at like 16 writing their own music and stuff. Like, I really discovered that quite late, I would say. Like, I think it was like 18 or 19 when I started like actually writing songs in a band. I might have even been a little bit later, like 20 maybe. Like, not that that's super, but like, if you look at people who've been writing music since they're 12, like, I would say, like, I'm really happy where I am now, but I feel like I'm sort of late to the game because of me starting late. And that's not an excuse. It's just like, I do feel like discovering that earlier, my whole life would be different, but like, maybe there'd be something else that happened along the way. But like, because that wasn't the case, I had one drummer who's a really good friend of mine, but he was in another band and just wasn't available. He's the drummer in my band now, because after you leave high school, grades matter less and all that stuff. And he's like still one of my best friends today. His name's Jordan. I guess I'll name drop him.
shout out Jordan.
Yeah, shout out Jordan, my drummer. And so then He was in a hardcore band at the time, and like this might make no sense, but like hardcore is the scene for like the Misfits. And I didn't really feel like I fit in there, but I didn't really feel like I fit in with the mainstream stuff. Cause like I would wear like a Papa Roach shirt or something, which like wasn't cool at my school, but it wasn't cool at the hardcore scene either.
Ah, crap.
So like, I felt like I had this like no home place, but I think it was just the people I knew at the time. I don't really think that was like a reflection of the scene as much or whatever, but like, the hardcore scene, like he kind of was getting out of that and like, hey man, we should start a band. So we did, and a few different iterations. We finally got some stuff set up, and then the drummer from Under Oath, he had a band called The Almost, and they were doing this contest to open for them in the States, and we submitted, and like, it didn't ask you to submit where you were from, so we submitted from Canada, and we won this contest to play in Spokane, Washington, to open The Almost, and it was our first show. And we spent like $2,000 to rent an RV and like, just like, and we played for free. Like it was just, but like, I wouldn't change this story or experience for anything.
No way.
Like, yeah. I'm glowing just thinking about it. It was amazing. It was a good time. And I mean, like, not a lot of bands could say their first show was like opening for like an actual like established band. Yeah, and like we sucked, and that's how it goes. And I don't know. It's been a journey ever since. Pathless Travels has just been this amazing outlet for me playing. Like, we saw Rancid and the Transplants playing together at Mac Hall like 10 years ago or whatever. And Tim Armstrong was like, hey, there's a reason our band has outlasted so many. It's because we're friends first, band second. And that really resonated with all of us. Like, there's been a lot of times in Pathless Traveled where someone hasn't been available for an extended period of time, or schedules didn't line up, or income levels didn't line up, or like, you know, the ability to invest in things like music videos and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I do believe a lot of bands like break up over those kinds of things. And maybe it's true that we could have picked an avenue that was more business focused or something, and maybe like gone farther. But like, I know wholeheartedly that none of us feel that way. Like, wholeheartedly, we're all extremely happy that we made the choice to stay friends and not let anything like that get in the way. So like, we're a local band, we've opened for a lot of cool bands, like I'm really proud of what we've done, but I wouldn't say we're like hometown heroes or like a band that, you know, sells out, you know, rooms across the city or anything like that. Like, I don't think we have that clout or pedigree, but I'm still very proud of what we've done, because we've been able to do some really cool things that I think a lot of local bands would love to do. Yeah. There's always another level, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we've done cool things, and there's a bunch of people who aren't maybe at that level yet who think, oh, that's so awesome. And then obviously you're always looking up. So like, it's all about your perspective, and I really try and be grounded with it and be like, I really appreciate what this band has given me. It's been amazing. And it's, I don't know, like one thing at a time. And, you know, we're not touring the world. We're not, it's not our full-time job. Like, none of those things, kind of the dreams you have when you're 16 or 18, 20, like none of those have come to fruition, but I'm very happy and satisfied with how things have gone. And it, yeah. And I think a lot of that is your perspective just in general. Like, I think a lot of jaded people, we've all met jaded people in the music scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a lot of people who had high hopes, things didn't go the way they want, and they blame external factors, you know, instead of them, how they responded to the situation. Yeah.
I actually did want to. Oh, sorry, Scott.
No, I was just saying, I just went like full spectrum. So if you found something you want to focus on, that absolutely.
I did want to actually talk about what we just listened to. Alcatraz, fucking banger. So good.
Thank you.
Holy shit. That got me hyped. I was loving every second of that thing. So I am assuming this is for an entire album. What's been happening with Pass? So like, what's the inspiration? What's the story, man?
That's the detriment of our band, maybe. It's like, we have illustrious dreams and goals, but then we have a hard time maybe getting together and making the machine be as oiled and as efficient as like contemporary, or not contemporary, sorry, that's the wrong word to use, but like as our peers. A lot of people put out a lot more music than us, a lot more consistently. Whereas for us, we take our time with things, for better or for worse. Hello. Oh, she doesn't have a blanket. Oh, okay. What? Oh, okay.
Hey, hello. That's okay.
Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
We had a dog being brought in. Oh,
buddy.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
So our band is a little, like, we have a hard time getting together and finishing things. So, like, we have a lot of songs that are, like, near completion. Like, the song is 3 years in the making, maybe four.
Wow.
3 years. So COVID's a part of it. Mm-hmm. But, like, we have very, like, high standards, and then sometimes we don't have the available time or resources to achieve those, so sometimes things sit on the back burner until they get there. And pardon me, we did have an album. We've decided to just kind of go release these next three songs as singles. This will be the first one. So, and this is out on your guys' podcast before it's going to be out. So anyone who listens to this, wow.
First run, thank you so much, man. It's so cool.
Yeah, you guys get to, hear a new tune. It's a cool song. I love it. I went to San Francisco when I was like 10, let's say. I don't know. I was a kid. And we went to Alcatraz. And there's this really cool story that's like in, it's kind of like an Americana at this point. It's like part of like America's great stories. And like if you're in the U.S., it's sort of like a urban legend kind of thing. But these two guys, or three guys, sorry, escaped Alcatraz, which is this island off the coast of San Francisco. The water is the ocean, so it's freezing. I think it's like 1.5 or 2 miles or something from the bay to the island. So the ships would have to wait for certain times where the tide was right to actually go. Otherwise, it was crazy. And the tide most of the time would be pulling people under the Golden Gate Bridge out into the open ocean. So aside of it, it was a maximum security prison on the island, but then also the body of water was another deterrent, basically. So it's something like 36 people tried to escape the island since the Civil War in the 1800s. Most of them were captured, some were shot, some drowned. But there's three guys that made it off, and they were never found. So there's no... It's cool. It's like, it's sexy, and it's like, I don't know, like since a kid, the story is like they made these masks out of paper mache and used like whatever they could find to make it skin toned. And they would throw blankets and pillows under at night and put the head in. They took hair from a barbershop and like made these masks to fool the guards. And then they like timed things. They made a raft out of raincoats and like used a steam press. They were reading Popular Mechanics magazine in prison. And they learned how to do this, like the literature that was provided to them, plus the IQ level of these guys, because they were super, super smart. The reason they were on this island, they were bank robbers, so they weren't like violent. I mean, like, I guess it's a form of violence, but like they weren't murderers, they weren't rapists, they weren't serial killers. Like they weren't like Al Capone was kept at Alcatraz and another guy named Machine Gun Kelly was kept there. So like America's worst criminals were sent there. They were sent there because of their incredibly high IQ and they'd broken out of multiple prisons. So they were sent there to be like, hey, like you're not escaping. And then they either got the farthest anyone ever has and didn't make it, or they're the only people who ever did.
Wasn't there a Clint Eastwood movie for that?
Yeah. The Clint Eastwood movie is literally about that. Yeah. It's a fun time.
I love that movie.
It's definitely like, you can tell it's an old movie because like every shot is 8 minutes long. Like it's not cut like a modern movie, but it's a fun time. And that movie like is very faithful to the story as far as my memories. Like I watched it like during the pandemic, I think, for the first time. But my memory serves that like it's pretty accurate. I definitely like hyperfixate on random things, and this is one that I really did. And typically I don't write songs about anything in particular. Like I'll have a concept or idea, but this is the first time I've written a song that's like about a story and about a perspective of like a character maybe. And what was really cool during COVID is there was these photos were released from the family that was allegedly them in Brazil in the 70s, implying they made it, but the FBI was like, I don't know, that's like, it's far-fetched, it's inconclusive. And then some private companies have done facial recognition, and very high chance, like their software says 99% chance that these two men in the photo are the ones from Alcatraz. So like odds are good. And there's a Discovery Channel documentary about it where they like went to Brazil and they find like an American coin in this certain spot, but like I don't know if that's bullshit and it was like planted. So like, like I don't know. Like shows are shows and reality TV is reality TV, so you can only take that so far. But like, if AI software is saying it's very high chance that that photo is correct, then like I don't know. That's cool, cool to me. And the U.S. still has the bounty open until 2030, where they would be 100. So like the, so like whether or not they made it, it's a cool mystical story and I've loved it since I was a kid. I sort of rediscovered it over the pandemic or re-remembered it, did a bunch of research, watched a bunch of documentaries on it, watched the Clint Eastwood movie, and then wrote this song from the perspective of the guys, basically.
Oh, okay. That's what the part in the lyrics, yeah. Because I wanted to actually go through and like read the lyrics. I'm like, oh, there's a story in here. There has to be. And I mean, you just basically laid it out for us.
Yeah, and so, the song leaves the ending open, too. Like the nice. Bridge is like them on the raft and their tenacity to, you know, accomplish this feat, and then just goes back to the chorus. And it's just like about being known for something. The chorus is about like a legacy, and I don't know. It's about like they're immortalized by this story. It's a very cool story, mm-hmm. and it's very compelling. Mm-hmm. And any story that like tests like lives this long, and like, you know, a 30-year-old who wasn't even alive when this happened is fascinated by, like, stories like that, or like D.B. Cooper or something, things that like
that's what I was really, thinking yeah, yeah,
they capture the mindset of people, and it's romanticized, and it's like I don't know, it's, and it, like I think it helps that they weren't like ultra violent people, they mm-hmm. were like just really smart, and they sort of beat this game that was like the you couldn't break out of this, like it was the prison you went to where like you were stuck there for sure. And like mentally, if you're in a cell that's behind bars and then you're like in a yard that has multiple barbed wire fences and then you're surrounded by like the ocean, that would be pretty much like I would feel pretty defeated.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just humans are cool. Like I don't want to say like I'm condoning criminal behavior, but like it's cool that we have this innate, even like, you know, prisoners of war is escaping from POW camps and stuff in World War II. Like, we have this innate desire to survive and to live and to experience life. And humans are very smart and very capable. And I think that's like a cool trait of humans. And that's what I would want to take out of that story. I'm not saying go rob banks, you know, but like,
unless it's easier to root for you if you do, though.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
No, that's such a damn cool story. But yeah, like you brought up the DB Cooper thing. Like now what I want is a concept album from you guys that just goes over all of these like mysteries, like the Dyatlov Pass and like DB Cooper and like people escaping stuff. And you know, that actually, I might take that idea for
do us, it. Why not? I think it's open. I did like, there's another thing that like another, I thought about doing like an Islands EP or something. Cause there's another place in the world called North Sentinel Island. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it or not.
I've not heard of it.
So I suck at geography. So like, I'm just going to put my foot in my mouth right away by saying this, but like, I believe it's off the coast of Thailand and it's under the jurisdiction of India, but it is this island that is quite remote. And there are like, essentially, like, I believe Neolithic is the word, tribes living there, and they're more or less uncontacted. So like they'll see like airplanes fly over or whatever. So like, they're aware of this world that exists, but like every time human beings go near it, they shoot them with arrows. Like it's like a "you are not coming here" policy. And in the 1800s, I believe, sometime during the colonial times, a ship docked and took some people with them. But because they've been so separate from society for so long, they like got the common cold and it was like wiping out the people.
Oh.
So two people died, and they went back and dropped off the two kids that survived. The two adults died, and then they took off. And that was like the last like sort of exchange, I guess. I don't know, calling people exchange is good, but like some philanthropists went a bit later and like had some interactions where they were sharing coconuts and stuff, but like that guy hasn't gone back. And since then, like a Christian missionary went and they like killed him, and like other people, like a ship crashed there, and like they're not like, they're very hostile, they're like, they want to be kept to themselves and they want to do things like exactly the way that, like, I don't know what I'm saying, but like they are very like particular and protective and not welcoming to outsiders, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And India won't allow people to go there because of the disease thing. Like I mentioned, like if COVID arrived there,
right, it would be over.
It would wreck them basically because they're so separate. So there's a concept of it being fascinating because if we want to know how, you know, older tribes and the hunter-gatherer mindsets like worked and diets and like their methods for things, like that's the closest thing we could ever discover. But by going there, you would like end it. You know, so it's like it's foreign and it's sort of like a similar like whimsical like thing to think about, but like they're protected for a reason, and like incredibly resilient like anything else. Like when the 2004 tsunami happened, I don't know if you guys remember that. They flew over to like check because okay, they're done. They like would have been decimated by this wave, and a helicopter flew low, and then they started throwing spears at the helicopter, like, get out of here.
Oh, so, wow.
Like, they survived that tsunami. So there's this, like, ancient knowledge that exists on, like, how to recognize when weather patterns are changing. And, like, I don't know. So that story, that island really fascinates me, too. Every couple months, I, like, Google it to see if anything new in the news has popped up about it because it's fascinating. So, like, that was another song I've, like, kind of considered writing, but I don't really know how to approach it, but... I don't know. Whimsical ideas are cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I don't know. If you guys do an EP on DB Cooper, I would listen to it for sure.
Have you got a release date for Alcatraz or the rest of them?
We kind of just finished the mix notes this week. So we are probably going to try a real like run ads, Spotify playlist push kind of thing, which like we've never really done before. With this song. So I'm assuming like late March, because I think you're supposed to do like a month for like Spotify curators to even consider your music. I'm sure it's still hard to like even get on, but like, I don't know. It's very different. Marketing is like not a strength of mine. But like we want to try because we never actually tried properly. Like we typically finish our record and then upload it to streaming 3 days later. Like that's who we are as people.
Yeah.
I have some friends who like they finish their record and they have a 3 month release plan. And it's like, I respect that so much. That's amazing. And you have the tact to do it. Like I need the deadline to pressure me to finish sometimes. And so I don't know. That's how we typically operate. So we're trying to be different with the song. So hopefully
I feel like we also learned that kind of same lesson when we released Zerotonin with From the Flame a few years ago. We had finished it. We were like really, really excited. And then we just wanted to get it out. And then we put it out and it just vanished. Nobody cared. We could, because we didn't do, you know, any of this planning for release. So now like we did that track with you a couple of months ago and we love it. It's fucking brilliant. And I'm like terrified to like put it anywhere because I just want to make sure we have a strategy this time. I don't want to make the same mistake twice. Right.
It's such a, like a teeter totter, you know, cause like you can sit on something for years, like the path of travel and like have things never come out. I think this is the value that labels really actually offered bands. It wasn't like it was the finance to record a record because it used to be really expensive, but it was marketing. Like it really was like marketing, putting your song in the right people in the hands of the right people, like knowing who the music directors at different radio stations were, having a relationship with them and getting them to play your music. Just one moment.
I was wondering, I was wondering what the final straw would be for that one.
Like, let me out.
All right. She may be back. But yeah, like, I think a lot of people shit on labels now. It's kind of like, I mean, it's been that way for a while, but and it's pretty easy to do. And there's been some examples, like A Day to Remember, where, like, A Day to Remember was, like, the norm, not the exception on how they were treated. But, like, there still is a lot of value that, like, either building a team around you or... like a label, I think can actually still offer you that. Like, I think it's like it comes down to self-awareness. Like, what are you good at as a band? And do you have members internally that can do things that can save you money? Cause that's good. And then anytime you have something that like, you know, if you really believe you want it to like be a top tier and like accomplish something, then you would need to treat it like anything else that you really believe in or like, And by saying that, I'm saying, if you're at your day job, mm-hmm. and you needed to accomplish a task, and you worked with your team to accomplish this task, like whatever you do for a living, you have sort of designates that are good at things, and then you send it out, or your business will outsource something that they're not good at. Like a lot of like say your construction company, typically they outsource their video person to make a video for the construction company because that's not what they're good at. And then they use that video, make ads, and then their construction revenue goes up because they outsource the thing that they weren't good at, the creative space, in order to increase their sales and marketing. And I think musicians were more creative. Like, and there's exceptions. Like everyone is different. Every band is made up of different people. But like typically creatives are not so good at admin. They're not so good at deadlines. They're not so good at consistency, like keeping up a marathon pace versus a sprint pace. Like, and I'm speaking about myself, like absolutely by saying this. So I would say, like, if your band doesn't have those things, try and find people who are and build a team and a relationship that way. You'll probably get farther. And mm-hmm. I'm saying this from having not done that and learning from the other way. I feel like this is for sure the best path moving forward.
Yeah. Actually, that kind of reminded me of something you brought up earlier when you were talking about, friends first, music second kind of thing mm-hmm. in the band. And that was something that I never really thought about because, originally I'm from Florida and I was in a few bands down there. Crazy. And it was always, I'm sorry?
Oh, crazy. I didn't know you're American.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not a native Calgarian.
That's cool.
Or Canadian. But yeah, in the process of immigrating and being down there, being a part of a few bands, like, it was like, oh, well, maybe this, or, oh, they're really good at guitar, so let's get them, right? You're just kind of grabbing good musicians mm-hmm. at first, and then you realize, like, especially now that we're a bit older and more mature, that it's like, well, I can't make music with somebody that I just can't stand. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care how good they are at their instrument. I don't care if they're perfect at everything. Like, it's just not something that's going to be built to last.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at even at, like, things like, I don't know, there's the phrase that, like, the shining star burns the shooting star burns the brightest, or, like, there's, that's not it, but you know what I'm saying. Pink Floyd can't stand each other. And I don't know if they're all still alive. Like, my knowledge is not perfect on this. But, like, they got back together for, like, a Live Aid thing in, like, 2008.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could just see that they hated each other. And, like, there was no real banter. And they got back together for charity. And was maybe it's the right call. But, like, they were not cohesive. They happened to be right place, right time, and became a phenomenon and were incredibly talented musicians. But mm-hmm. like, they didn't have that camaraderie. And sometimes that's a good thing and sometimes that's a bad thing. But like, I think sometimes unhealthy people get an opportunity early and things kind of take off. Like, sometimes the universe or God or, like, whatever you believe in sort of picks you, or you're in the right place at the right time, and you get to go on this journey that other people don't. But it doesn't mean that you're any healthier or less healthy than, like, someone else who doesn't have that opportunity, I think. Mm-hmm.
No, that's a really good way to put it. I've got another one kind of, like, going off into more like the producer territory or somebody who's at home recording. You know, we're talking about labels and, Rory and I can't remember if we talked about it on the pod or if we just talked about it just face to face, but labels these days are kind of, they help you with a lot of things, but you don't need a label to be successful. Like, a lot of people, I mean, you know, hell, we're doing it with you with this album. You know, we want to work with you, and, you know, you're somebody who, like, we can work with to put out our music. But, you know, as far as marketing goes, like you said, we'd be like, hey, Scott, market our stuff. You're like, dude, I don't even know how to do that with mine. But exactly. So for somebody starting out, like, and what are some basic tools?
Basic, like, tools.
So basic, like, recording tools. So if you're, you know, whether you're that 16-year-old kid who just got a new guitar, or you're like, oh, I kind of want to start recording, like, what would you say, like, the basic three essentials to have, or four, however many, like, you know, what did you first start getting when you started, like, wanting to record and produce?
The wrong things. For sure. There's a few, like, factors, and it depends on specifically what your end goal is. But really, the important things are quality items that do what they need to do well without issue. So your computer, if you're mixing, like if you're producing and mixing, your computer is actually probably your most important investment you can make. Because if your computer can't handle large sessions, or you don't have the storage space for modern recording where it's, everything's like 150 tracks or whatever, like you're going to be bogged down and limited by your technology. You're going to be limited by your assets. Or if you have a guitar that's not intonated and your G string is always out or something, and when you're playing octaves, it sounds like ass. Like, you can't fix that with really cool, sexy plugins and stuff. And, like, you hear this time and time again that gear doesn't matter. And then you see someone who says gear doesn't matter turn around to their Kemper and their Helix and their Quad Cortex and their 87 guitars. And, like, none of this matters. But, like, you have it for a reason. And you're like, you want to believe that, I don't know. Like, there's two, there's two mindsets with that kind of thing. But, like, the answer is what you were getting, make sure it is quality and is not going to hinder you. So a guitar that's set up and intonated, doesn't have sharp frets, it doesn't matter if it's a Squire, if it's a Fender, or if it's a Harley Benton or Gibson or Epiphone or whatever. Like, when you hear it, you can't tell. Like, most people can't listen to a record and say, oh, it's that. You can tell single coil or humbucker or active pickup maybe, but like, you're not going to be, oh, that's a Gibson ES-335. Oh, that's a Strat for sure, right? Like, not usually. And like, some people maybe have that ability, but you're in like the 1% or something. But like, if the guitar's out of tune, everyone will notice. Mm. If the intonation is bad, everyone will notice. Your guitar track will sound amateur. So when you buy a guitar, make sure it's quality. Make sure the pickups don't rattle. Make sure the truss rod is fine. That's what matters. When you get your computer, prioritize as much as you can on your RAM and your hard drive. Mm-hmm. And your processor, which I didn't really even know what all that stuff was, and I still don't really. But like, those are the numbers that matter for production. And then when it comes to speakers, get the best speakers you can. I would say, like, KRK is not the best brand, but then there's someone like Hardy, who's a really successful country artist, and he has. He uses KRKs. So, like, nothing really matters that much. It's how you use the tools that you have. So I would say speakers that have holes in them or speakers that are damaged or have distortion that you can hear, don't get those. But, like, get something, the best thing that you can afford for your budget that hopefully isn't going to be limiting to you. So speakers, interface, that applies to everything. And then when you have your set budget, you can divvy things up as you need. But it's way easier to save up and buy the piece that you know is going to help you, like, pragmatically, and buy something once than it is to buy the cheaper version, then the mid-tier version, and finally land on the nice version later.
Yeah.
And there's some things where that doesn't matter. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
You're just working with bad equipment, and you're not getting the right read on it, especially like if your speakers are blown or something's happening, like with you know, a number of things, right? I remember before we went to go record with you were like, make sure your guitars are set up, change your strings, like, do that, because you're right, like, when you're capturing, when you're recording anything, it's taking whatever the state of that instrument is, and it's like, you know, solidifying it into time, right? Like, it's permanent. So I think that's a really, really solid start, is making sure that you're spending the right money on the right equipment and you're not cutting corners where you probably shouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, the best analogy I can think of is like, let's think about a photograph or a picture. If you have your picture, but your camera is slightly tilted. So instead of it being level, it's slightly tilted. And, like, there's artistic photographs, so we're not talking about that. We're just talking about, like, a photo you would post somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. It's slightly angled, and then your subject is slightly off-center, and your lens is slightly out of focus, and there's a little bit of dirt on the lens. The picture you're trying to portray, there's some distortion in the way from what you're trying to demonstrate versus what the actual subject of your photograph was. Can you guys hear my dog barking?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I apologize.
No, it's all good.
I might go grab her. I can probably clip this part.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. I'll make it cleaner. I'll go get my dog because she's clearly just barking at the window or something. Cause no one's home.
Something's really bugging her.
All right. Anxiety blanket for the
dog. All right. You found the blanket.
We're good. Yeah. You guys remember the
blanket? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Picture.
Oh, yes. Picture. Right? Picture. Yeah.
Okay. So, everything that's in your power. So like, yeah. Okay. So this photograph you're talking about, camera's tilted, the subject's slightly off center, the lens is out of focus, and there's dirt on the lens. Mm-hmm. These are all things that expert photographers know, and they check these things. So the only thing that's different is the user of the tool and knowing what needs to be done to get those roadblocks out of the way to get the image across to people. Excuse me. So these are all things that are really in your control. Tilt the camera, wipe the lens before you go, make sure it's in focus, make sure your subject is center, and you're much better off. Now, if the subject of the photo is boring, if it's not an exciting photo to look at, if it doesn't stimulate something, then no level of photography skill is going to fix that. So if you take this mindset into music, if your guitar is out of tune, if your strings are old and sound dead, if your drums are like kind of all over the place, there's not fresh skins on them, like all these little things that you have control over, it costs a bit more, but you have control over these things. You control the controllables to get the best possible outcome. Mm-hmm. Every decision you make is going to increase the quality of your product by 2%, 5%, 3%, whatever. And each one of them maybe doesn't matter. But when you add them all up together, you're getting probably something between 10 and like 40% or something. So all these little decisions do matter. And you can hyper-focus and split hairs, and like that's not a good thing. That you can go too far with that. But making the right decision and having a clear vision from the get-go helps you achieve these things that are much better. And that's how you get things that like some guy records in his bedroom when he's like 16 years old that just is mind-blowing and everyone loves. Like even like the SoundCloud rap sort of phase was like empowering musicians to just make music. Yeah,
sorry. It's a way of life.
Well, yeah, it is. I apologize. No disrespect. But it was enabling artists with very little to accomplish amazing things.
Yeah.
And the best engineers are the people who have that attention to detail and make those right decisions. So even things like, hey, I want this to sound like Limp Bizkit. Okay, so then don't use a Fender reverb with a Stratocaster, you know, like the, or like a Telecaster, sorry, with like a single coil. Like, don't do that because you're not making the decisions that will help you get a Limp Bizkit tone. Or like, hey, I want this to sound like Spirit Box. Okay, then don't have your guitar in standard tuning. Like, these things, like, they matter to get your focal point and your vision across. You make these decisions and work your way towards your final product, and it's going to be a lot better. So to the beginner, to the person who's just starting out, what matters is your attention to detail, your discipline to get better at your craft, and then the best quality item in whatever category that you can afford. But don't let that hinder you, because people have done amazing things with, like I just bought this bass for $200 from Europe. It's a Harley Benton. Sounds phenomenal. Plays really well. And you would never know on a recording. And like, if there's brand snobs out there, there probably are. But like, it sounds great. And I can use it for pop punk or metal. And it's perfect for my studio. I just didn't have a P bass and I didn't want to spend a lot on it because I prefer jazz basses for the most part. So that's my main bass and that's great. But I wanted to have a quality one that was going to get the job done. And this bass is exactly that. Like, it's not some crazy expensive signature or whatever, but I can absolutely use it with a pop punk band and we'll get a great sound out of it because the quality is there on the item. And it was only $200. So like, you, price and value aren't always the same thing. It's about the intonation. It's about the action. It's about the pickups, like all those things. Like, does it sound good? Yes or no. That's really how the best way to be objective is this good? Yes, no, move on.
All right. So what are some producer tips for musicians going to the studio? Some things that make the process go more smoothly.
I think there's maybe three things that I can think of.
And did we do so, them?
Yeah. No, you guys did. You guys were very well rehearsed. Being rehearsed is number one. Knowing your parts, having your lyrics written before you show up to the studio. I think there's room for harmonies, you know, like have your lead vocals down, but like writing harmonies or writing it a little like this sort of feeds into the next spot, but like be rehearsed and ready, but like also be willing to like have subtle changes. Like maybe there's a better way you could approach a pre-chorus, or maybe there's something that you could add like a shot here or like you could do a drop chorus instead, or you like, hey, maybe tambourine would be great on this chorus or whatever. Like these little things that like sometimes these little things that sometimes when I suggest them to people after they've chosen to work with me, they're like, no, I don't want that. I don't want this. I don't want, like, I just want this to be the way it is. And like, I think I try and avoid this situation by asking a band at the very beginning, do you want my input? Yes or no. And if they say no, then it's like, okay, from the beginning, I know I'm just recording and just like, hey, this is out of tune. Let's keep going or whatever. Like they don't want my songwriting or production input, and other artists do. I think it's always better to get a fresh set of ears because you've been sitting with your song for so long. And then when someone hears it, like, oh, this part feels rushed, or like this should be halved, or this should be longer. Those suggestions can really make a song stand out. Or like if you're thinking about like, I don't know, clay or wood, like whittling or carving or whatever, like taking away what doesn't need to be there so that you're left with a beautiful, you know, work of art or whatever. So I think the first thing is be rehearsed. The second thing is be open-minded and be willing to make subtle changes, or like be 80% prepared and let 20% be that studio magic. Like, what if we did this kind of thing? I think on your guys' song, we like added a little bass part in the pre-chorus or something. We changed it a little bit, right? And it's pretty cool. And like, does it change the entire vibe of the entire song? Probably not, but it makes that moment more interesting and it's exciting. Mm-hmm. I think we all agreed when we figured that part out, like, yeah, this is a good change. So like things like that, allowing moments like that to happen, I think is really, really important. And then I think the third thing is, it's kind of band specific, but like sometimes bands come and someone's in the hot seat, like recording, and then the other guys are just like talking super loud and like not really giving the respect to their other musician. And in a larger studio, that's fine because there's like a coffee break room and there's other things. But like in smaller home studios or whatever, or typically like in a band jam space, if you guys are making your record yourselves or whatever, like treat the moments that are important with respect. And every moment is important on a record, and everyone's time is important. So like, I do find sometimes bands have like the main songwriter who everyone respects and like that's it, but like the bass player or like the drummer or like their ideas are like viewed as less or whatever. I think the answer, like, maybe I'll add a fourth thing: say yes to every idea, because you never know. So that like, you can like, someone could suggest something and it's like, I don't think so, but you try it. And then usually when you try it, the person who has the idea will even be like, yeah, that's right. Like that wasn't the right fit. Thank you for trying my idea. And other times you try the idea that no one thinks will work, and then everyone's like, what? And it changes like the whole, like everyone gets excited about it. So like, say yes, respect every idea, and then have the humility, if the idea is yours, to be like, okay, yeah, that wasn't it, man. Like, that's totally fine. Like having humility, because at the end of the day, everyone wants to write a great song that a lot of people like, or like you're writing it for yourselves, but like you want to write music that like resonates with people and like creates some sort of vibe. Like that's like part of the artist's journey, I think, is like you make the music for yourself, but you want to experience it with other people after. And I think if that's everyone's goal, then why would you like, oh no, like that's a great idea, but I didn't come up with it, so like there's no way we can do that. And like, I used to be like that in my band early on. I really had to work on that. And I've learned just like checking your ego at the door so that you guys can all just create something cool, or like there's no bad idea and you try everything. Like, it's a way more uplifting, positive, creative experience. And it's typically leads to better music.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved having your input when we were in there. It's so awesome to get all those fresh ideas in. And it's right, it's like just getting a fresh set of ears on it is super important, because like we're so stuck
in it.
We've been like working on that song for like what, just say a few months, and then we finally think we get to the end of it and we're like, that's just how we've been hearing it. And then, you know, you come in, you're like, oh shit, what about this, what about that? Like, there was some, like, man, you put so much awesome stuff into it. It really works. No, thank you for saving us on.
I love that. I love that experience. Like, it's, that's like, honestly, if there's anything I love, my days where I get to spend like a full day with a band and we're like just all excited and creative. Like, there's nothing like that. Like, a 12-hour day feels like 2 minutes for me when I'm doing that. Just being in a room with people who are excited to be there, who are motivated to be there, who want to make, like, something really exciting that they're proud of, and everyone has, like, a high standard, and we're not going to cut corners, but, like, it's also an upbeat environment where it's not feeling monotonous and meticulous, you know? I guess, like, at the very first question you asked me was, like, why I got into recording. I didn't really get that far, I guess, but we recorded our album and our first record, and we spent $5,000 on it, and it doesn't sound like we spent $5,000 on it. And part of that is experience. Part of that is the songs weren't very good. Like, I absolutely think it was our first record, like, and we were, you know, young. There's a lot of that. And I don't know if anyone really loves their first album too much, but, like, the experience was very expensive and very stressful because you were stressed about the finances. So you're playing worse because you're stressed about the finances, and it just wasn't a creative, collaborative, exciting experience for the most part. And that mantra, like, my experience is what has driven me to sort of build the experience that I offer at my studio, or, like, that I believe I offer in my studio. But, like, based on what you guys are saying, that's very much a goal and value of mine, is, like, I want my studio to be an environment like what you guys are describing. Mm-hmm. And, so because of that experience, I've really tried to turn that into a positive, and I really do I feel like for myself, I've achieved that in a way that, like, when I offer something to people, I do feel like the value that they get is that environment where, like, you're not stressed about money recording in the studio, and you don't really, you almost feel like you're not paying for it, sort of, because it's just a sort of an additional member of the band who's not really in the band, who gets along with everybody. And like, not that I put on a face to do that. Like, I love people and I love interacting with people. And I'm sure you guys have seen that after spending some time with me. I just love spending time with people. And, like, I want the studio experience to be exciting. And, like, that's what makes it exciting for me. So that's definitely something I aspire to. And I would say if bands are recording themselves, try and still create that environment. Like, you're with some of your best friends. A lot of bands will describe their bandmates as brothers or sisters, or, you know, depending on, but there's a camaraderie that exists, and we're choosing to do this. We're choosing to spend a lot of money to make something that maybe our grandparents will listen to, you know? Like, we're choosing to spend our time, our energy and our talent to make this. It's so awesome that we have that, because I know there's a lot of people who can't even find people to jam with, right? So we have that, and we get to create something. So, like, that's a privilege. That's something to be excited about. And there's no reason to make your environment stressful or toxic or angry. Just, like, be excited to have what you have and make the music that you're working on. And I don't know, mindset's huge. If people are stressed and down in the studio, I do believe the track actually suffers, or it takes longer to get the final result. Maybe the final track doesn't suffer, but it takes longer to get there if you're not all, you know, cohesive and moving forward as a unit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, fuck. I've got one more for you, Scott. Sure. I feel like this is probably the most important question we're going to ask you today. So feel free to, like, just, you know, let it marinate and come up with the correct answer. Favorite brewery?
Who's my favorite local band? Okay.
we wouldn't be that cruel to you, but favorite local beer or brewery?
Okay, for sure, Toolshed. My knowledge is not extensive on other local beer breweries, and, like, I'm always open to trying new things. Like, I like Last Best; I think they're great. But Graham at Toolshed did something really cool for the province. My knowledge of this story is not perfect, so, like, this is paraphrasing, and go look this up, but it was illegal to have a microbrewery in Calgary, or, like, it was illegal in Alberta to have a brewery that was smaller than something like Molson or whatever. Like, I don't even know who's here, but, like, it was illegal to do that at that scale. So he was making beer in his tool shed, and it was illegal, so he was making it in BC and then bringing it back. And he really pushed for legislation to allow for local breweries to exist in Alberta. And since then, there's been a pretty big, like, resurgence, or maybe resurgence is probably not the right word because it wasn't there before, but like a growth and a presence of local breweries and that branching out. And I think the tool shed story is really cool in that way. Plus, I think People Skills is just like my all-time favorite beer on the planet. It's very drinkable. It's great for like summer barbecue stuff. I could drink a vat of it. I did a couple shows at Tool Shed the past year.
How was it?
And I mean, you're playing in a massive tap room, so like it's cavernous and a little crazy. But I loved it because like I got People Skills for free and their barbecue food. Like their burger is phenomenal.
Oh yeah, I haven't been there since they started doing that. Free.
It's exceptional. Like their burger is so, so good. And just because I was working the show, I got to have a few beers for free. And I was just like, dude, I'm getting paid to drink my favorite beer. Right now. This is great. Yeah. Yeah. And like, I don't know the full story. It is on Graham's website and he does do like speaking events. So it's possible you'll be at an event sometime where he's speaking and telling the story. But I think what he did is really cool. And Graham is a person, after meeting him a few times, he's a very, very kind, exciting, passionate person. And I love passionate people. So that would be my answer. But that's not knocking anything else. It's just like my experience with Tool Shed has been great. And I don't have as many experiences with other local breweries. So I'm in no way knocking anything else. But that's just that's my experience. That's what I like.
It's as good an answer as any, actually. That's really cool. You just taught me something. Like I had no idea that Tool Shed was such a pivotal like player in the movement to get it going here.
Yeah, it's really, I don't know. Look it up.
Yeah,
sometime.
I remember I went on a brewery tour of Tool Shed like a long time ago, and it was Graham that led the tour, and he told the whole story. And you're right, he's a wonderful speaker. Like he can really tell a story really well. But it is fascinating, like what he had to do to like get beer into the damn province.
Yeah, to make it legal.
It's so preposterous. And was it there was something about the barley that was being grown or something, right? And it was like they had to like export Alberta barley to BC to then bring it back or something like that, right?
There is something like that. Like my details are fuzzy because I heard him giving the story as a tour, as I was setting up audio equipment, and I was like, this is insane, but I didn't catch all of it. So like, yeah. But that does sound at least mostly correct. And you know, if anyone's listening who knows the full story and is shaking their head, I'm so sorry for letting you down, but like we're only saying positive things about Tool Shed.
Yeah, now there are three idiots on this podcast.
Exactly. Happily. Odd champion chief idiot for sure.
Scott, do you have anything you want to plug? Do you have any dates coming up for Path?
We're looking at doing a show at the end of March with 2 Liter Superpunk. I'm hoping that's happening. Just confirming with my band, making sure everyone's available. But hoping that's happening. That should be good. But I don't know. If you're hearing this and you want to make cool music, hit me up. I love making music with people. I'd love to hear your demos and hear what you're working on and potentially work together if it's the right fit.
Rory and I can definitely attest to a wonderful experience. Like we won't make you pat yourself on the back, Scott, but we'll
absolutely
do it for you. It was phenomenal. So yeah, if you're in the market, you're looking to make some music, you're looking to really just create some fantastic art with somebody who actually knows what the hell they're doing. Cause I know I don't. And every time we walked into your studio, I'm like, just in awe at what's on your computer. Like, I have no idea what these buttons do. I feel like I'm going to launch in this one. So
I probably could. With this
but the right, yeah, the right sequence.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
You have been fantastic for our first guest. Like, that was unbelievable.
Yeah. You set the bar pretty damn high, Scott.
Oh, sweet.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you.
Later.
See ya.
Well, guys, there you have it. Scott Bennett of A Path Less Traveled and Interim Studios. I really hope you had a great time hanging out with us today. We sure had a great time hanging out with you. We will see you in a few weeks. But until then, stay frothy, Calgary.